The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to a special between-season bonus episode of Origin Story. It's hot off the presses because we're going to be talking about something topical which chimes with a lot of what we've been discussing in previous episodes. It's what, surprisingly, nobody seems to be calling Linacagate. I'm Dorian Linsky, author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute and the Ministry of Truth.
And my name is Ian Dunt. I'm a columnist with the Iron Newspaper and I'm the author of How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't.
So, Ian, what is Gary laid on a platter for us in origin story terms?
We got delivered an awful lot of origin story over the last 7 days because we didn't just get delivered fascism. We also got free speech. So we got two for the price of one.
Right.
And at that point, I think it became irresistible.
And even within fascism, you know, kind of two, I think, distinct arguments going on. And I was very gratified to see sometimes on Twitter that I was looped into somebody sending somebody else our fascism episode and going, listen to this. This clarifies this. I don't think Peter Hitchens listened to it.
Do you not? Do you somehow suspect that he wasn't interested?
I mean, he's normally like a groovy, open-minded guy who doesn't mind admitting when he was mistaken. But maybe he was just having a bad week.
Yes, it's possible. That is
so
possible.
Where to begin?
Well, let's begin with the tweet. So the original tweet is from the Home Office. Enough is enough. We must stop the boats. It's important to mention that because this is the thing that Gary Lineker's referring to. Mm. Gary Lineker's response. And I want to preface all this by just generally saying that I really, really like Gary Lineker. As I don't particularly like football, but he's always just seemed very lovely. I was always really genuinely impressed with the way he managed to switch careers and then be very, very good at a completely separate thing, which most footballers, when they try and do TV presenting, really struggle with. Mm. And I obviously, it goes without saying, agree with the general moral thrust of what he's getting at. That being said, he is completely wrong, I think, or we'll discuss that. You may be more sympathetic, but I was not. So he says, all right, he's replying to someone. There is no huge influx. We take far fewer refugees than other major European countries. Fine. This is just an immeasurably cruel policy directed at the most vulnerable people in language that is not dissimilar to that used by Germany in the 30s.
Right.
And again, the language is enough, we must stop the boats.
Right.
Although I suppose you could be speaking more broadly than that, but yeah.
Yeah, so I was very intrigued by the reaction to this because, I mean, I think we do need to talk about the free speech issue. Was Gary Lineker allowed to say it?
Yeah, that'll come later, right?
That'll come later. I mean, in terms of that, here's my take on it. I think that it's largely inaccurate to say that, but it points up a problem that we have as a society with historic analogies is that most people do not know much history, right? They maybe remember what they learned at school. You know, the Nazis loom so large, I mean, so disproportionately large, as we discovered in the fascism, you know, there was a lot that actually we didn't know about Mussolini and about the actual origins of fascism as opposed to Nazism. What do you want to clarify? Peter Hitchens, the Nazis were fascists.
Oh, that's crazy.
That's definitely insane. Yeah, definitely true. So what that means, I think that there's a sort of paradox that the analogies that are accurate are not impactful, and the analogies that are impactful are not accurate. Because, you know, to bring up one sort of major, I mean, there's many, many, many distinctions. It's not simply, I don't buy the idea that any mention of the Nazis is automatically invoking the Holocaust. You know, I think people are aware, as we discussed, you know, the Holocaust was something that was really, that was some years down the line, was only made possible, you know, by a wartime situation. So obviously, if you're saying something reminds you of the Nazis, you're not necessarily cutting straight to the final solution, right? Mm-hmm. But even then, you know, the analogy that I would use here, okay, what he's talking about is inhumanity towards refugees. Now, for obvious reasons, there were not many refugees trying to get into Nazi Germany. largely they were trying to get out. And the recent Ken Burns documentary, very good, America and the Holocaust, I believe it's called. What it shows is that what Suella Braverman resembles is actually the rhetoric of America and to some extent Britain.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
At the point when Jewish refugees were desperate to get out, like Anne Frank's father, for example, applied for asylum in America, didn't get it. There were lots of, it was a mixture of kind of just general xenophobic, nativist, isolationist thinking, and some actually very prominent anti-Semites in the American government that really did their best to stop Jewish people, I mean, and therefore condemned them to death, essentially. Now, that is a sort of moral disgrace. And that seems to me the apt moral disgrace. Historically, that seems to be the behavior of the British government at the moment. It seems to be much closer to that than it does to the actual Nazis, who obviously had a whole, you know, sort of exterminationist, racist policy. Mm-hmm. They wanted to eliminate Jewish people from German life. It wasn't, they didn't start with the Holocaust, but the aim was always to, you know, to sort of drive them all out. That's not what's happening here. And sometimes when I said that to people, it was almost as if I was like downplaying the malice of the Home Office. And I just thought, well, this is kind of screwy that anything short of the Nazis as an analogy is somehow considered weak sauce. You know? Whereas I think if everybody knew the way that America and Britain and quite a lot of other countries, actually, you know, the Evian Conference, I think there was like one country, this is 1938, one country agreed to accept, a higher quotient of Jewish refugees. You know, that was appalling. And if everybody knew about that, then I think Gary Lineker could have gone, it's like the Evian Conference, and people would go, oh, right. Mm-hmm. But of course, they don't know about that, broadly speaking. So I don't blame Lineker, particularly in a reply. He didn't write an essay here. This wasn't even his first tweet. Yes. It was a reply to someone. I don't blame him for using the analogy that everybody knows. But at the same time, I don't think it's the right one.
In terms of the blaming him thing, of course not. And we all say all sorts of things on Twitter that we're just like in a bit of a faff. And we don't expect them to be picked over by every magazine, every newspaper, every current affairs program for one whole week of national attention.
Yeah.
And very few of our tweets would survive if we did. I mean, it has this sort of double effect. I mean, the first one is that we don't have the check boxes for what fascism is. But even if you do on the most rudimentary level, you know, as we were discussing in an episode, this wouldn't really satisfy any of them. You know, the use of sort of sub-rational sort of, you know, charisma and iconography.
Violence.
The violence, exactly. The intense conformity. The most you can say is the real sort of like the fetishization of the in-group in a very extreme sort of form of in-group fetishization, out-group sort of venom. That's as close. But the thing is that, and there's so much, there's just, anti-immigration feeling is so common on almost all parts of the right that if you were to use that as a real, oh, this is the danger switch towards fascism, you very quickly find yourself calling even quite centre-right parties, you know, fascistic. And I think you'd sort of rule yourself out of a normal conversation. I also think, because of precisely what you've just said, that actually the correct analogy is with our own behaviour in Britain and America. I know far less about that. During the war, particularly towards Jews trying to escape, that it lets Britain off the hook.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. So it's part of that laundering thing that Nazi Germany provides of everything bad that
represents
has ever happened in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And indeed all anti-Semitism, which was absolutely not the case.
There's a boat, and I wish I could remember the name, and that boat, do you know it?
I'm embarrassed. It was turned back from Cuba.
So it goes to Cuba, and then I think it tries in two separate locations in the US. And I think they can see the lights of Miami for a couple of days as they're trying to negotiate things. And eventually it gets sent back, and most of the people on that boat were killed in the Holocaust. And that boat was raised a lot during, you know, debates on not just the UN Declaration of Human Rights, but also the UN Convention on Refugees.
Right.
And it's specifically that document that we are infringing right now. You know, when the government right now says illegal immigrants, the people in boats, what it's doing is trying to do a legally false interpretation of the word direct in the Refugee Convention to say that word direct means you can't have passed through another country.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not what they meant legally on an international level, on a domestic level. That is not what it means either.
And of course, most Jewish refugees from the Nazis would have passed through another country.
Exactly. So even now, most of our actions, if you look at the debate on this bill, the things that can be done to protect people against this bill and the things that the bill is infringing on relates to that convention. And that convention is based on the experience of what happened with that boat. And that is based on what Western countries did with Jewish people trying to escape Nazi Germany rather than what was happening in Nazi Germany at the time.
I think it's that problem of, I suppose, what you call sort of, you know, Nazi exceptionalism. This assumption that all of the terrible things and all the different ways you can treat people and treat the, you know, the vulnerable people and treat the other are what the Nazis did. You know, so people were talking about when I pressed them, I go, well, exactly how is it like the language of 1930s Germany? And they go, well, you know, othering, you know, dehumanizing, xenophobia. And it was like, well, you know, the Nazis were so far beyond that. It wasn't about stopping people from coming in. Mm-hmm. It was about removing people, and not Jewish people, but, you know, Roma people and, you know, homosexuals and social. I mean, it was there was a kind of a racial mission to sort of purge the Volk. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like really, really extreme versus what you said, like just treating minority groups badly, treating refugees, you know, being inhumane to refugees. That is a lot of countries. And you say conservative countries, but of course, you know, Roosevelt was president when a lot of Jewish refugees were being turned away. Mm-hmm. You know, that was deeply, I mean, it wasn't coming from him, but it was sort of deep in the kind of machinery of the American government. And so that, I suppose, is what I worry about morally, not what some people are saying, which is an insult to victims of the Holocaust, because I do think you must be able to talk about 1930s Germany before the Holocaust as something else. Not that it was a slow build. That's like a total myth. But it's not the same thing. It's not every mention means the death camps. But it does center all evil and inhumanity in this one regime, when in fact we should be looking at all the other countries, you know, in the 20th century, 21st century, that have done this, that have treated people badly. Why don't we invoke authoritarian regimes at the moment, such as Orbán's Hungary? You know, why are we? And this is beyond Lineker. I think he is just, I'm not criticizing him personally at all. I'm just saying it is a symptom of the fact that actually there are these many forms of right-wing authoritarianism.
Yeah.
Many forms, as there were, as we discussed. You know, Franco was not the same as the Nazis.
Yeah.
Salazar was not the same as the Nazis. You wouldn't want to live under them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I wish there were more reference points. It's a little bit like, you know, when someone, people don't do it so much anymore, when people used to kind of quote Harry Potter, and there was that meme on Twitter, you know, I'm begging you to read another book. And it's a bit like that. I am begging you to read another history book, and at least to understand that these are certain things that people do, that governments do, that nationalism does, that was not unique to the most genocidal regime in history.
Well, the thing is also, I don't think it's so impossible to remind people of this. And I get it that our historical brain as a society goes to that place. But, you know, one thing is about trying to create the purity of the race by the removal of enemies to the race, which is, in that case, was the Jews, and the removal of those who are considered social pollutants, you know, like gay people and asocials and et cetera. And that is just a qualitatively different thing to the process of hardening your heart to the point of just complete moral collapse by screening yourself off from ever helping someone who is in that kind of situation and trying to run away from it. And two things can be fucking dreadful at the same time, you know, but they are different things that are dreadful. You know, cabbage and kale are both terrible, terrible things, but they are terrible in a completely different way from each other.
I'm not going to be drawn on this. No, but I would allow a Children of Men analogy, having recently rewatched Children of Men. You know,
I love the way you'd allow it. So now in our tiny bunker, we are.
Well, I will allow that. This is my list of permitted analogies. I feel like there was almost a moral disagreement, you know, that I saw playing out, that some people feel like it is morally essential in order to condemn, to be able to invoke the Nazis and not be criticized, and any criticism is sort of nitpicking.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another argument, which I would say is that actually it's sort of, it's morally essential to have a broader frame of reference and understand that there are certain things that are sort of part of human nature and nation states. And, you know, it's that it could, it, you know, I suppose it's that it could happen here. Now, it does not mean Hitler, but it's bad enough. And just a bit more, I mean, I don't know, you can't call for some more historical literacy. I actually do not know what the solution is. Because even you say Stalin, well, that's an obvious one. Actually, a lot of people don't know that much about Stalin's Russia. They don't know about, you know, they don't know as much about his crimes. Like, how many things are there in history? I was trying to work this out in, say, the last 100 years that you can invoke and people will get it. Okay, mm-hmm. Second World War and the Nazis, First World War, Pearl Harbor, people know what that is, Hiroshima, 9/11.
Mm.
A lot of things have happened in history that have, that do not have that broad currency. They're not the equivalent of the songs that everybody knows. And so you're almost inevitably stuck. I was in that weird position as a kind of historical, you know, buff or pedant. I don't want to say pedant because I don't think it is pedantic.
I would say pedant.
You say pedant, all right. But if somebody obviously, you know, presents the show, you know, obviously I'm thinking, well, you know what, there are better analogies here. On the other hand, when I saw people where that was their first thought, was like, actually, I'm not sure that's true. You know, that's true. That seemed to me kind of a little off.
Mm-hmm.
When, of course, you can see what he's saying, see what he's criticizing. And I suppose that was part of the bigger problem, that we had a week of talking about Gary Lineker and the BBC rather than talking about this very inhumane bill.
No, that was terrible. But, you know, this all very quickly got trapped into, you know, no matter how distant you tried to be, you had to be thinking, like, does this help or does this hinder? You know, so like lots of debate is like, well, does this actually hurt the government or not? And actually, because you get wrapped up in that, it's quite hard to extract yourself.
What did you think? Do you think that that kind of hyperbolic analogy was hurtful more than helpful?
I think it's actually more pertinent on the second half of what we're going to talk about, which is the infringement of free speech. I think there is a big public, you can get that sense of public support for people being able to speak freely. And that's where it actually became quite damaging to the government on what it was trying to do. But on the actual, I've got to say, I have a very pessimistic assessment of human nature and the British personality when it comes to refugee issues.
Mm.
I've never really seen any sustained data that makes me think otherwise.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, putting in these terms and pumping it to this wider audience and in that capacity, I just sort of thought probably this won't work out too well for us.
The free speech issue then led to another really glib analogy, just going, well, if I didn't want to be compared to the Nazis, I wouldn't be pressuring the state broadcaster to silence voices. And I was like, again, if you actually look at what the Nazis did with the media,
not the pressure so much as
not
just
the
murder.
Not the same. I it's sort of that thing. I think it's part of kind of what I call like sort of left-wing doomerism. It's not specific to the left, but I suppose anti-Tory doomerism, which is to sort of think that everything is as bad as it could be. And if somebody goes, if you dare to sort of go, well, it's not quite that.
Mm-hmm.
It's somehow like, oh, so you think it's fine then?
Yes.
You know, you have to believe that basically we are on the verge of a sort of V for Vendetta fascist takeover. And if you go, no, but here are all the ways in which this is really bad, and there is the potential, I mean, I don't think it's very likely at the moment, you know, potentially you could go, well, you could see an Orbanism.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially in Britain, like it, that would be a way off. But you know, you could make that argument.
Oh, you definitely can. Yeah, I'd say during Johnson's period, you could definitely see you take over institutions. Yeah, there's all sorts of.
You know, there are more, and I think that draws your attention to. It's that whole thing of alarmist language. How justified is it? Are you drawing attention? Does it work because you're drawing attention to something, or does it backfire? Because when you draw people's attention to it, they just go, well, it's not as bad as you're saying.
Well, this is the thing. They'll always say that, right? When we did that episode, one of the debates is, you know, does the word have to be just stuck in that 30s period,
right,
you know, with these parties, or can we use it now for things? And I very strongly feel that it needs to be part of the armory as an early warning signal. And I feel like over the last few years, there have been two events that really, where it really in my head just felt like the right word. And one of them was Trump's inauguration. It's like bookends. One of them was Trump's inauguration. And the other one was the storming of the Capitol.
Hmm.
And in both of those cases, I mean, just even if to look at it visually, the inauguration just felt, it felt like a fascist ceremony. I mean, did. And of course, you wouldn't say this is fascism now, but you would certainly say there's something pretty fashy going on over there. And I don't feel very great about it. You know, this doesn't feel like, you know, even if someone like Pat Buchanan or something had sort of become president. By the time you get the story of the Capitol, I think, again, you see that sort of central role of violence, the quite clear attempt to overthrow sort of democratic processes. And suddenly you're just that much closer that I think you can start using it. I haven't really seen anything from a British government that would authorize the use of the word. I think when we started using the phrase the will of the people during the Brexit period, that felt like the early stranglings that can lead to something much bleaker. Because that, you know what that means and what that indicates, that kind of homogeneity, which is not typically part and parcel of the way that we talk about things in this country. But apart from those two occasions, I've never felt it at the top of my lips. This is a very basic bitch point, and I'm sorry for saying it because I've heard it all my life and it's very, very tiresome, but there is a truth to it, which is that if you start saying it for everything, when you do need to say it,
right,
I don't think people are going to listen.
Well, before we move on to the freedom of speech point, I suppose there's a little sidebar that thanks to Petronella Wyatt and Peter Hitchens, we had a revival of the Nazis were actually left-wing discourse.
Would you like to hear it in full?
We have fully addressed in the podcast, which I believe every British citizen has now heard.
It's mandated now.
Yeah. So I'm surprised to hear it again, but perhaps they defied the law.
I have it right in front of me, and it is quite spectacularly stupid in a way that's quite hard to believe he's actually managed to achieve. Nobody seems to know one crucial fact.
I love that. One crucial fact. Not an opinion. It's a crucial fact.
And nobody knows it.
Nobody knows it. No one knows.
You've never heard this.
If you look at the name.
he is an actual bona fide fucking moron. The Nazis were very left wing. There follows the evidence. They hated Christianity and deliberately set children against their parents. They imposed penal taxes on the middle class and attracted communists to their ranks. Yeah, that's
his tweet. That's incredible. I mean, obviously, he did then write an article and then a 12-inch remix of said article with more information. But I mean, the truth, let me just say, the truth in what he's saying is that they were not, if you have just an incredibly stupid, ahistorical sense of what left-wing people do and what right-wing people do, it is true to say they were not classic conservatives, right? That, I think, is fair. You know, with the, of course, they wanted to sort of replace the family unit with the party and all that. That's not what your typical conservative wants to do. So if he'd just gone, the Nazis weren't conservative, I mean, I would say that's true in both senses of the word. Yeah. They weren't conservative. But the whole history of the scholarship of totalitarianism is basically going, yeah, left and right is not really going to help you out here. And this is why people were so confused in the 30s, where they're like, are the Nazis ultra-conservatives? This is what the Marxists thought. You know, are they a kind of socialist, which is what some of the conservatives thought? You know, no, they were something else, which is why there was the weird kinship with Stalinism. It's like this is, he's presenting it as if nobody's noticed before, and people just thought that they were like Tories who liked uniforms. And it's like, no, we all know that there was this was a distinct, you know, phenomenon, a very complicated phenomenon. And as we discussed, you know, Italian fascism, not the same as German fascism. It was just the way that he just presented it as a kind of like, did you know? Like, people think this, but actually it's that.
I'm embarrassed, you know, because I used to think relatively highly of him. I have to stress the word relative. But I just thought, you know, if people went, okay, so who are the people on the right that are worth sort of reading, you know, listening about? Yeah, he would have been one of the ones. I remember sitting and watching a debate on Newsnight between him, weirdly, and Chandler from Friends on whether addiction was something you had any control over or whether it's a disease. And it was pointlessly, it was such a false binary, you know, whatever. But as he was talking, I remember really recognizing just how weak the sort of standard left-wing view on these things felt. Like, it just felt like you just have no control over your life. And it's so unconvincing. And I think probably philosophically wrong when you just start stripping out any sense of personal responsibility and personal sort of freedom and autonomy from politics. So there were elements of that. And then now you just look at it and be like, he must have always been an idiot. It can't be that he's just degraded like this. He must have always been a moron, because only a moron could have written what he wrote there.
The reason I hate this debate, and we've discussed this, right? We've discussed, why is it called the National Socialist Party before Hitler took over, by the way? You know, we talked about the Strasserites and how they would have wanted to take it in a more sort of quasi-socialist, you know, national. The whole point is that it's the national. It's the nationalism is more important than the socialism, right? We talked about how Mussolini was a former socialist. Like, it's not as if there's nothing to this.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, you have to really sort of understand, like, the whole chaos of it. So if you're interested in the history and the kind of the strains that we talked about, you know, imposed on the First World War, and the way that people had, like, there was no set definition of socialism. So some people would just say that they were socialists in a way that we would not. Mm-hmm. Recognize now. Okay, that's the historical approach. But what this is really about is using the Nazis, like, everybody apart from, like, swastika tattoo guys, you know, agrees that the Nazis were bad. So they are used, therefore, as a cudgel. So, of course, if you're sort of Gary Lineker or whatever, you're using the Nazis as a cudgel to hit the Suella Braverman. And if you're Peter Hitchens, it's like, well, you have to use it to hit the left. Mm. And you end up with absurd stuff like, you know, of course, the most important thing about the Nazis was that they turned children against their parents, but not in a kind of like groovy fucking Woodstock flowers in your hair kind of generation gap way. Like, not that. And so I suppose that's where I find it quite offensive, because all it's doing, it's not trying to improve people's understanding of the peculiarities of fascism. It's simply using it to, like, tarnish the modern left. But of course it doesn't make any sense, because you're talking about something that really you're sort of evolving 100 years ago. So it's got nothing to do with the people that Peter Hitchens doesn't like now.
Well, it's sort of tempting, isn't it, to do a kind of centristy, oh, look, on the left, Gary Lineker misrepresenting them, on the right. But I don't think that they are morally equivalent.
Oh, no, because, not morally.
And I'm not suggesting that you're saying it. But, like, the thing that you can genuinely say about the Lineker tweet, even if we think it's factually and historically wrong, is that he is seeing a minority group being targeted. And once, you know, refugees are in the country, they become a minority group. And comparing that with a regime that was very, very famous for targeting minority groups.
Yeah.
And so not only does that allow you some kind of, it's very pastel colored and I think weak lines, but, you know, some kind of, you know, intellectual similarity, but it also, more importantly, gives you the moral sort of dimension in order to make the comparison. I don't agree with it practically or morally, but whatever, you can make that case. The Hitchens thing is just completely different, and it's a million miles away.
It's not coming from a good place.
It's not coming from a good place. It doesn't have any of that kind of intellectual or moral connection to it. And most importantly, it just shows just a complete lack of interest in being accurate about stuff that really does fucking matter, in order so that you can, you know, get some wire and put it into a big thumping weapon and try and twat someone over the head.
Well, attract communists to their ranks. What did they do to the communists then?
Yes, exactly.
Did they kill any of them? Another thing also he thinks that nobody's heard of. He said the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, one of the least known about events of the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, he's got an incredibly low opinion of his readers. I've noticed this. These are absolute morons who know nothing, and he has to enlighten them. So, I don't know. I think people do know that Hitler and Stalin, you know, teamed up. And again, that was not just kind of like, well, that means that the left and right are the same. It's like, no, that's totalitarianism. I don't know, man. I just feel like I've spent so much time with podcast in my, you know, like, Orwell book, and, you know, obviously, you know, this stuff comes up in your liberalism book as well. It's like, and to see it reduced to that is so debasing and embarrassing. And you also want to say to him, you know, let's just, you know, were the Nazis left wing or right wing? And he goes, who sort of likes the Nazis? since Second World War, which groups like the Nazis? Is it the far right or is it the far left? Turns out it's always the far right. Like if you see someone with a swastika tattoo, you don't think, oh, that's pretty woke. Like, you know that they're going to be very, very right wing. And so you can't just sort of go back to kind of like, you know, the terminology of the 1920s to prove, scare quotes, that they were left wing. It's weak. It's like it's a settled issue. It's sort of settled. Like nobody thinks. Mm-hmm. Nobody thinks that they were simply left wing, except people that want to hit the left wing now. And that to me seems like the worst use of history. You know, particularly the history where, you know, millions of people died.
Yes. You might want to tread quite carefully and make sure that you're getting your stuff right.
Yeah, and that distinction you make is so important because he's doing it in a very, very cheap way. And Lineker, even if it's a hyperbolic comparison, is coming from a place of compassion and outrage, and that is just entirely different.
Yeah, the side that you're on does matter, I think.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Okay, so relatively briefly, considering that we've now spoken for half an hour, let's do the free speech element of this. I thought this worked out very, very interestingly indeed. Now, I'm well aware that there are other dimensions to this. We could take the impartiality thing. We can also take the fact that, frankly, that I think there is an attempted but quite weak government takeover of BBC management structures when you look at sort of Robbie Gibb, mm-hmm. and Sharon, and that is quite separate, really, to the free speech debate. However, what fascinated me about what took place is, you know, that cartoon, the one that you, I think, ranted about for probably several minutes at a time,
yeah.
in free speech.
Yeah.
Like, oh, there's consequences, right? And we right, can right. choose, you know, yeah. you've got free speech, but there's consequences. We can choose to show you the door and blah, blah, blah. What's extraordinary to me is, A, that was pretty much every line from anti-Lineker people yeah. on the right during this period. But then, extraordinarily, when I remember, I pointed this out on Twitter at one point, and the replies to it for people on the left, where I sort of said, look, there's a bit of a lesson here, you know, because let's not be hypocritical about it. Let's not pretend, you know, the same time that was blowing up, there were calls to remove, I'm so sorry, I can't remember the name of the host of Question Time.
Fiona Bruce.
For a bit sort of scrappily and messily interjecting during things, to have to put, you know, Boris Johnson's father, Stanley Johnson's point of view on a domestic abuse
right.
question and kind of mangling it and getting
botched,
it a bit
yeah.
wrong. She botched
yeah.
it a bit, but there were calls for her to, you know, basically be sacked from the program. Mm. So you could still feel that pumping sense. If you look at Lineker, if he'd said something that could be interpreted as sexist or racist, I think there would have been lots of calls on Twitter. They wouldn't have succeeded because they wouldn't have had the privilege of being, you know, repeated in the Mail and the Express and therefore access to government and ministers. But there would have been calls for him to have been, you know, to step back from his role. Be sorry for it. So I saw no learning on the left to see that actually this thing cuts both ways. And that if this is your feeling on free speech here, it should be the feeling on free speech for people you don't agree with. Instead, what I got given back was a lot of people saying, well, the thing is about free speech is that there's consequences. And you think, no, you're looking at the consequences right now. Like, there is no state agent knocking down Gary Lineker's door. But is he being censored at the moment? At that point, he hadn't been
right.
censored. Yes, he is experiencing censorship right now.
Yeah. I mean, I did think of my man George and the statue of my man George outside the BBC.
Oh, shit, I walked by it that day right. and I'm just looking at it to be like, oh, my God.
Which is kind of hilarious because when he worked for the BBC, he had two layers of censorship that he had to go through because it was like during wartime, right? So there were two different censors. So when freedom of speech means, if liberty means anything at all, it means the liberty to tell people things they do not want to hear. Okay, that was certainly not the job of the BBC when he was working for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really the job of the... And it's a weird sort. It's not really the mission statement of the BBC. That is, you know, it's more provocative. It's, you know, he was referring to when he couldn't get Abnormal Farm published. You know, it's far more sort of provocative. I have no idea why they use that quote. It just seems to me like, you know, it just becomes a stick to beat them with.
That's so interesting. They'll never be able to live by it.
Mm. No. But what it came down to me was not so much freedom of speech. It's the impartiality policy. A lot's been said about this. So I suppose for me, it just seemed like, right, you just have to be consistent. And this actually comes up when people talk about freedom of speech issues on Twitter, Facebook, wherever. You know, it's like consistency, transparency, you know, clarity. So you kind of know where you are. And that was where, you know, they didn't have a leg to stand on, because of course people could say, well, look at what Andrew Neil tweeted. Mm-hmm. Look at what Lord Sugar tweeted. So clearly there's no consistency there. As I understand it, impartiality is not the same as political neutrality. Impartiality is on air. So Nick Robinson, former Young Conservative, whatever, you know, on the Today program, I personally don't detect a Tory bias. I think he works very hard to do his job impartially. That doesn't mean that I don't think he has political beliefs any more than Paul Mason. I was pretty sure even when he was on Newsnight that he was pretty left wing. But you know, he took the job of impartiality seriously. That's all that you can ask of people. So when they say, oh, well, so-and-so used to be a member of the Tory party or whatever, it's like, well, that's not a gotcha, because it's what they do on air. You know, if Lineker was on Match of the Day and just, you know, going, you know, talking about how much you like Mick Lynch or something, you think, okay, that might be a problem. Neutrality off air seems to be a completely different thing, which you can demand of, you know, Nick Robinson or Laura Kunzberg or whoever, people in the news division. But you can't demand, because if you're demanding it of Gary Lineker, well, who, you're going to demand it of anyone. You could demand it of, like, Sarah Cox or, you know, David Attenborough. I mean, David Attenborough's got strong opinions about climate change. Presumably that's fine. So there was simply no logic. And that was where that was, to me, where it just seemed it got into a problem. Of course, there are going to be restrictions on free speech if you work for, you know, depending on your sort of contract, your relationship with your employer, even if you're a freelancer. But they need to be clear, because otherwise it does just seem like censorship, as opposed to something that you have agreed to in advance.
See, it's funny, right? Like, part of this is part of the sort of right-wing culture war front, which I think is to deny that impartiality can ever exist. When you dig into words like the blob and the deep state, that kind of sort of Ribena-level conspiracy theory stuff, ultimately, it's that impartiality can't exist. You know, it's the same comments that you've just made on impartiality about, you know, you are that when you're doing the job and you're not otherwise. It's exactly what you'd have with the story about Sue Gray joining the Labour Party. You know, it's not supposed to be that Sue Gray has no political opinions outside of work, or has no political opinions once she leaves work. Mm. It's that when she is acting in that role,
right,
she is impartial in her behaviour. And yet the response to it tacitly assumed that no one is capable of doing that. And the criticism you get of the BBC from the right tacitly assumes that no one's capable of being, you know, impartial or even handed, if they have, as they do at the BBC and as they do in the civil service, they're completely right about this, biases towards metropolitan, liberal, progressive sort of thing, because they're young people working in London. That's right, what they are. Yeah, you know, yeah. The people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, that is what they are. So I think that's extraordinary. However, I do think that part of this was not about impartiality, and part of it could be assessed by the general way that organizations respond to a sort of mob demand, whether it's online or in the papers, to silence someone. Yeah. You know, and you would get it you know, if it's an actor who said something about COVID, you know, or not wearing masks.
James Gunn, I was thinking. Do you remember James Gunn was sat from Disney over some old tweets?
Right. And that was actually another attack from the right, yeah. A very cynical one, because they didn't care less about his tweets. It was just a chance to get rid of him. And that part carries over. It's not really, impartiality happens to be the sort of stick that's used for the BBC, but with any organization, you know, whether it's the Disney Corporation or whatever, there is that. And then it's about the organization thinking, how do we respond? Do we actually maintain some kind of pretty firm walls against that sort of attack and protect our, you know, as long as the behavior wasn't happening at work and wasn't said at work, blah, 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 do we actually try and protect people? Do we actually care about free speech as a value? Or do we just give in to whoever demands that we get rid of someone? Because that's frankly the easiest thing to do at any given moment. And what was interesting to me about this moment was it obviously feels different when it's the B, because you've got the papers behind you, you've got the ministers behind you. It's not just a sort of ground, grassroots sort of Twitter thing. But nevertheless, it felt like there was a learning exercise of, no, there's consequences too when you get rid of them. You know, if you try to push them away, you might suffer some pretty severe consequences yourself. And I think it's quite useful for organisations, including the BBC, to realise that fact.
Who knew also that the most no Pazoran solidarity forever group of people in Britain was in fact sports presenters and commentators?
It's incredible.
I mean, it was just like full, like, you cannot do this show. Because we're all with Gary Lineker. And I was like, holy moly. I can't think of another industry where you would just have like...
I found it quite beautiful. I've got to say, I was actually quite moved. Like, as it kept on just coming up and coming up. And of course, once you reach a certain point, it almost becomes safer for you not to do it, because you've got to stay within the critical mass of, you know, you don't want to be the one scab.
You'd look pretty bad.
You'd look terrible. But nevertheless, I was genuinely quite moved by that. And I thought it was quite a beautiful moment in its odd way.
Well, to sort of stray maybe into the woke episode, I think the problem is also that with these kind of bad actors on the right, you know, the Mail, I just think if basically people... the power the Mail has over the BBC is absolutely absurd. Yeah. You know, it's just not that important a publication. It's often backing the wrong people. It's pushing positions that are not broadly popular a lot of the time. I don't know why it should be so important.
Look at it with Partygate. It's completely off its tits, and yet still people act like it sort of summoned up the mystical nature.
They're really into Liz Truss.
Yeah. I mean, yes, exactly.
Like, it's just they do not represent the voice of, you know, Middle England. Anyway, that annoys me. But also what these people are doing, I think is to expand, and this is a culture war thing. We're going to mention all the episodes now. Throwing Ayn Rand and Joe McCarthy. No, but it's to make everything political. And so when it's about expressing political opinions, now, obviously, yes, Lineker was criticizing a new government policy, but he has a long history of supporting refugees. This goes back, you know, quite a few years. Now, is supporting refugees a political issue? Is that a party political issue? Considering, actually, who's probably stronger on this than Labour. Mm-hmm. You know, is that a party political issue? Is belief in climate change and doing something about it a political issue? Is belief in therefore wildlife conservation, is that a political issue? Belief in trans rights, gay marriage. There seems to be so many things which are actually, you know, really important personal values to people, that places like the Mail, they want to make that seem as if, oh, well, this is lefty bias, to the point where actually it's almost impossible to have any sort of moral positions or opinions at all, because they're all political. Now, I think impartiality should be, don't perhaps show your hand for one party or another. You know, if Lineker had just gone, can't wait for Labour to get in and boot these guys out, I think that would have been very different. But to, you know, not every single opinion that you have about the world is political in a sense that would endanger, you know, the BBC's reputation. Because otherwise you're just going to end up having, like, no opinions at all, right?
We have got to get to the point where we can tolerate the idea that people may think differently to us, and yet be fair-minded when they're engaged in the business end of what they do. And honestly, the honest truth of it is, I think Andrew Neil, I hate to say it, because I think he's an absolute prize bell end, I think he was the best example of this. Because not only was he impartial in that he was actually really quite intellectually impressive when he was on camera, and then when he was off camera and he was tweeting, what you discovered is he was A, wrong about everything, and B, kind of an idiot. So you listen to what he would say when he was on TV, and you listen to the manner in which he interviewed people that he clearly agreed with. You just thought, well, that was just impeccable. Like, you've just ruined this guy who I think you're 100% on the same page.
But this is something where perhaps I think maybe is more of an issue, because I'm mostly criticising the Mail and the Tories here. But this is something that I think a lot of people on the left are unwilling to do, is to grant that separation between on-air impartiality and personal political neutrality. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, once you have been, I'm not talking about Richard Sharpe here, who does appear to be extremely biased towards the Tories, but I'm talking about broadcasters. And I do think you have to give people the freedom, as I'm sure, you know, they weren't complaining about Paul Mason. You know, I think you have to allow people to do their job professionally. And Andrew Neil, he's like a very, very right-wing man. Mm. And, you know, wasn't it like Boris Johnson wouldn't be interviewed by him because he was...
Yes, he ran away from him.
Because he ran away from him. You know, and that's that. I know that's a strange separation because I think that there is a culture now, particularly on social media, of you must be entirely consistent and you must almost sort of, you know, never write for a publication that has different politics to you. Never be less than, you know, pure and honest and always saying your opinion at all times. But actually, the BBC couldn't, and other broadcasters actually, other than GB News, you know, couldn't function like that.
Mm.
Because otherwise, all you'd be doing is hiring people who have no politics at all. And that is a real danger because it doesn't mean that they're kind of, these are not like wise like Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, they're just like both sidesing stuff that should not be both sides.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So it's not as if you want people that have no opinions and sort of no moral values whatsoever. And that's the perfect broadcaster. So, you know, I do think it's important to be able to sort of actually look at people's work and not do the old, oh, well, there, because Fiona Bruce, I think, is married. Her husband was a Tory donor.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You know, now, I don't know. I think it's totally fair to criticize what she's like on air, but I don't think that the smoking gun, like, is her husband. And I don't think smoking gun is like, oh, when what they did in university and running for office and all that lot. Because, again, I think you've got to apply consistency to that. And unless you want, and, you know, the Mail would like nothing better than to root out any broadcaster that had ever had a passing acquaintance with the Labour Party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think we want that. And I think you should judge people on their work.
Which is why we're held in such low esteem. Right, let's
I wish I was judged on my associations rather than my work.
Thank you very much for listening to us. This has been your Extra Origin Story podcast. We'll be back actually very, very soon with a topic that has almost no connection to the news agenda. We'll see you then.
See ya.
Origin Story was written and presented by Dorian Linsky and Ian Dunt, with music and audio production by me, Jade Bailey. The group editor was Andrew Harrison, and Origin Story is a Podmasters production.